The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
This is Demetrius Spinrad.
And this is Isaac Meyer.
And you're listening to Criminal Records, a podcast about some of the weirdest cases in true crime history.
That's right. And today, I have a little bit of a change of pace for you. Something a little different from last time. I've been digging through some of the books I have lying around on Roman history and have found not one, but two cases from the Roman civil system of the late Republican period that we can talk about.
All right. Are we talking about some of the most powerful men in Roman history being put on trial here? Is this one of those cases where the entire Senate comes together and tries somebody?
Absolutely not. We are doing civil cases, both of which involve the relationship between the law and women in Roman society. So I think this is going to be a really interesting because it's not a topic I imagine a lot of folks know that much about. But I think it outlines a couple of important things about the Roman system, which, of course, our own system in the United States and many other ones borrow some features from. And B, just as a historian, is a great example of how we can kind of talk about the stories of those whose lives are never centered as much in kind of traditional historical narratives. Plus, Roman law is just buck wild, so I'm kind of excited to talk about it.
All right. I am so excited. So which case are we jumping into first?
Okay. So we're going to start with a case from the late Republican period, specifically 100 BCE. One quick note before we get in. I have an interest in Roman history, obviously, but it is very much an amateur interest. I have never studied Latin and I will do my best. But if you know Latin, I am sorry. We are going to start with a case about a woman named Fannia and her relationship to Roman laws around dowries, marriages, and adultery.
This one sounds like it's going to be spicy.
Yeah, so this is a sexy one. This is a fun one. All right, so Fannia, we don't have many details about her life. We know that she is a citizen of a city called Minturno, which, if you know your Italian geography, is about two-thirds of the way down the coast from Rome to Naples along the Tyrrhenian Sea. So cities outside of Rome and Italy at this point are either socii or allies of Rome, or they are incorporated into Rome and their residents are citizens because Minturno is strategic and valuable. It's a port city. Its residents are Roman citizens, including Fannia herself, which will be important. Other fun fact about this, about 10 years down the line after this case, Roman allies will actually literally start a war against Rome to force the Republic to let them be citizens, which is called the Social Wars. So it's literally just that let me in gif, but like an actual military conflict.
Okay, this is really fascinating because I feel like over especially, I would say, the last decade or so of pop history, we've really moved into talking about any kind of relationship with empire as one of subjugation of everyone around them, which in fairness is a lot of history, but that is a very different relationship with the empire next door than I was expecting.
Absolutely. I mean, Roman allies after a certain, you know, originally that was more of a voluntary role, but when Rome became the dominant power in Italy, it really was not. And the allies were expected to put in kind of the work of helping the empire, but didn't enjoy the same benefits as citizens, which is why the social war happens. Because the allies are like, if we're going to, you know, we're kind of stuck with the Romans at this point. So we want to be all the way in if we're going to be in. And the Roman government was not too keen on having to give all these privileges and being less able to exploit their allies for that reason. Anyway, so this particular case, we have two sources from it, and these will color our understanding a little bit. First comes from a man named Valerius Maximus and his text, Memorable Deeds and Sayings. He is writing about 130 years after this case, And his goal is to write a compendium of weird historical anecdotes that public speakers, politicians, rhetoricians can draw on to kind of build out their speeches and make their cases. He's got about 1,000 anecdotes, and they're mostly related to Roman history. And it's a real content goldmine for us because they're divided into themes like military careers or parenting or omens. But there's also a whole section of infamous crimes, which is where this comes from. So I'm going to be going through that in the future and seeing what we can find.
That's very Roman to have an entire section of your histories just dedicated to omens, just omens kind of happening. Good omens, bad omens, general omen related things.
A lot of omen related issues, a lot of chicken based omens. I remember that from my study of Roman history. The other source we have is Plutarch, who is a bit more famous, Greek biographer, born in the 40s CE, so about a century and a half after this case. And of course, he's famous for his book, The Parallel Lives, or in longer form, The Lives of Noble Greeks and Romans, which is intended to be this like didactic work about teaching virtue, where you pair a famous Greek person and a famous Roman, and together their stories illustrate a moral virtue or vice. So like Alexander and Caesar, he pairs the two of them. Both Maximus and Plutarch don't really care that much about Fannia. In a bit of foreshadowing, they're very excited about the judge in this case. We'll get to them in a bit. So they're a bit light of details on Fannia specifically. Anyway, this case is all about dowry. And if you don't know what that is, this is a fairly widespread practice until pretty recently in history, still occurs in parts of the world. Essentially, it is a gift from the family of a bride to the family of the groom or to the groom himself. It's very common in patriarchal cultures where the wife is essentially being transferred into the husband's family. And that's absolutely true of Rome, which was a very patriarchal culture, with the paterfamilias or family head having enormous legal and really like substantial authority over the whole household.
I remember when my family had to give your family many cows to accept me.
Yeah, I mean, I was angling for a goat, but you get what you get. So there's no actually way of registering marriages officially in the Roman system. So dowry serves as a kind of marriage certificate. It's a way of proving that a marriage is above board and is not, for example, a concubinage, which would in turn affect the legal rights of the wife and any children that she has. So dowry is a way of registering a marriage as official without actual paperwork for doing that. This is also why if you were a rich Roman in the Republic, one of the ways you would do charity work is by paying the dowries of poorer women to show how much you love those traditional family values.
Wait, really? There were entire Roman charities devoted to just paying the dowries of the less fortunate?
Not in an organized sense that we'd think of it, but if you were a rich person, that was one way you would show you were charitable. There's not like an NGO, but it would just be like a thing that you would do as a rich person.
Oh, you don't have to file the old 501c3 paperwork?
You know, I don't know if I'd call Roman law tax law more or less complicated than our laws today, but it was certainly wild either way. That might be a good future episode. Tax farming is a really good one down the line.
Oh, that sounds like exactly our kind of bullshit.
So the funny thing about this case, Plutarch specifically says that Fannia will get married and then demand her dowry back, which implies that she is independently wealthy and the one who paid it herself. We don't know how much the dowry was or how she got the money. Neither Maximus nor Plutarch give us a monetary value for her estate. It's a little unclear how she could have gotten this or managed it, because Roman law did really treat women as functionally equivalent to minors with pretty limited legal rights. They do have some. And the fact that she doesn't have like a male authority figure doing this in her life, like launching the lawsuit for her, suggests that either her family is all dead, or she was legally emancipated, or she was born from an illicit union out of wedlock. It's not entirely clear, but somehow she's become legally independent, or legally independent, or her whole family died and then made a boatload of money somehow.
All right. I'm starting to really root for Fannia here. She is making it in a man's world, although I am not aware of that being a classical Roman virtue. So how are things going to go for her when she asks for her dowry back?
Not particularly well. So she is going to run afoul of Roman law, because there's one other thing I should tell you about Fannia. She apparently was a very horny person. Plutarch describes her as a dissolute woman. Maximus uses some other adjectives like unchaste, loose, or a lewd woman. Not entirely clear what that means, but apparently this was a reputation she had, that she fucked around a fair amount.
Continuing our streak of Roman figures that I would like to party with, Fannia, call me.
Yeah, she was pretty cool. Now, I should note, at this point, sex outside of wedlock is not a crime in the Republic. It's under the domestic sphere. This is a domestic crime, so it's the job of the paterfamilias or the male head of household to handle these kind of things. They could punish you. They could even kill you for adultery, but the law has nothing to say about that other than that they have the authority to do it. 100 years after this point, during the early Roman Empire, the first emperor, Augustus, will make adultery a crime by passing the Julian laws on adultery as part of his plan to make Rome great again by restoring its traditional family values. But that's more of a moral panic about upper class women not having enough children in wedlock to fill out the Roman aristocracy and military, and also a cynical ploy by Augustus to bolster his own reputation as a man of the people. And also, it's 100 years down the line, so don't even worry about it.
Tell us how you really feel, Isaac.
I have feelings about Roman emperors that come from many places, like my politics and the horrible things they did to Jews. But fuck all of them. That's not why we're here. Fannia, so she does have this reputation as an unchaste woman, but also she has a shitload of money. And that makes her attractive as a marriage partner, regardless of her reputation. She's not what you'd call a traditional Roman wife who is supposed to be managing the household. Most of their job outside of that is weaving, which is why brides would carry a spindle and distaff as a part of the wedding procession. But Fannia doesn't really strike me as that type. Even so, she got a lot of marriage offers and accepted one from a guy by the name of Titinius. And she apparently decides to take it. It's not entirely clear why she would accept, other than maybe to get access to a man who can serve as her legal guardian, which it does seem like a lot of Roman commercial law required during this time period. Women needed to have some kind of legal guardian in order to engage in certain contracts. This is referenced indirectly in a speech by Cato the Elder. But Cicero would also say about a century later that women would often ignore their guardians or give them orders and tell them what to do. It's not entirely clear how much power that relationship actually had, but it's possible that's why she agreed to it.
Yeah, the problem with trying to reconstruct stories like this entirely through third-hand accounts of what happened in a court of law is that nobody says whether anyone involved was a hot babe. Maybe the guy was just really hot. Maybe he was just husband material. We don't know.
Maybe he was, as they say, a husbando. We do know that he wanted her because he wanted her money. That's pretty clear based on what we're about to talk about. But he never, of course, explicitly said that. Then, as now, marrying someone for their money was a bad look, a bad vibe, you might say. Anyway, as part of this marriage, she provides a dowry for herself to make everything above board. And, of course, that's nice for Titinius. The two have a son together, Quintus Titinius. Fannia also has one other son by the name of Gnaeus Fannius. It's unclear whether he was born before or after the marriage, but he's given the nomen, the clan or family name of her family, not his family. So it's clear that he was born from not their marriage. Possibly because of this illegitimate son, Titinius, or for other reasons, Titinius will then decide to split the marriage up around 100 BCE. Again, we don't know what the official reason was. The suspicion is that possibly it was because of Titinius, who again may have been born after the marriage. It's just not clear. Anyway, Plutarch will label Fannia as the one who instigates the divorce. Maximus will say it was Titinius. It is possible under Republican law for women to demand a divorce during this time period. And here's where things get spicy. Any marriage that ends in divorce requires the husband to return the dowry. And if the dowry was an object and it has lost value since it was given, the husband has to make up the lost value. However, there's an exception to this rule. If the divorce is caused by infidelity by the woman, none of the dowry is returned. Of course, it doesn't work the other way around. Men can fuck whoever they want. And in a case of a divorce, that doesn't affect the dowry.
All right. So we have a case here of what's essentially ye old legally mandated prenup coming into play.
More or less. Exactly. Right. Like Fania is trying to demand her dowry back. Titinius is saying you were unfaithful under the law. I get to keep it. And so Fania denies that since she no longer has a male guardian because she's trying to get a divorce, she sues him in court of law to get her dowry back. That's our case.
Okay, so this is a society that does not have paternity tests. How on earth can you prove infidelity in a court of law?
So we're going to get to that, but basically the burden of proof here is pretty low. It's going to be entirely up to the official who judges the case to evaluate the evidence and decide whether or not to keep it. It's very dependent on who you get as a judge. Normally, a case like this would be judged in Minterno in its court, but the value was way too high, so it's sent to Rome instead. There's like a minimum threshold or a maximum threshold Minterno's courts are allowed to judge. And so that brings our case to Rome and to the Roman civil system. And I want to emphasize again, this is a civil trial, not a criminal one. So like with the criminal trials we've talked about in Roman history, the case is brought before a magistrate. In this case, it would be the urban praetor, who is responsible for managing the city and its court system. In a criminal case, the praetor would then accept the case, set up a jury, all the stuff we've talked about before. Here, it's a bit simpler. In a civil case, the praetor appoints what's called a iudex, spelled like judex, but it's Latin, so it's iudex, which is where the word judge comes from. This is supposed to be a private citizen who is uninvolved in the case, and to ensure fairness, both litigants have to agree on who their iudex is going to be. If they can't agree, the urban praetor picks for them.
So this is almost like a jury system in that you are going to be tried by one of your peers, except you get to pick the peer personally, and they're not just randomly volunteered by your government.
Yes, there's a whole kind of list that the urban praetor gets of who can serve as iudex. Once someone gets picked, and again, it's by choice of both litigants or randomly from the praetor if they can't agree, then it's all pretty straightforward. They are essentially being tried by one of their peers, like you said. And the trial is pretty quick. The urban praetor will give the iudex a series of judges' instructions. Very few of these survive, but the formula essentially appears to have been the charge is X. If charge X is proven, you must do Y, otherwise do Z. Both sides will then give their respective sides of the story in relation to the charge, and then the iudex will decide based on both their understanding of Roman law and the case itself. Two fun things about this system. First, the iudex can borrow from, but is not required to follow legal precedent. Second, there is no appeals process for civil law during the Roman Republic. Criminal cases, there is one. We talked about that with our episode on Publius Horatius. But in this case, not even the urban praetor can overturn the decision of the iudex once it's made. Once it's done, you are done.
So you better choose that iudex well, because that decision is staying.
Absolutely. Both sides also can invite lawyers. Again, that's not officially a system that exists during this time period, but unofficially, you could give someone a gift and they would be moved to speak on your behalf. So essentially, there are lawyers during this time period, but both sides appear to have agreed to represent themselves in this case.
Wait a second. There is no official system of having a lawyer to represent you, but you are allowed to just bring a guy into court who just stands up and gives a speech just out of sheer joy of giving a speech in the court and also clearly having been paid.
Yeah, the idea is to avoid the overt appearance that you can buy yourself a better chance at success in the court system. But of course, you can still do that. You just have to disguise it again as a gift. You've given this person a gift because you appreciate them as a friend and they appreciate you as a friend. So they're going to, give this speech on your behalf.
You don't have a lawyer. You have a mascot.
I like that characterization, actually. That's pretty good. So let's get to the reason we care about this case, or at least that Maximus and Plutarch cared about this case, which is the iudex who gets picked. The Eudex they agree on is one of the most famous men in Rome at the time and possibly also ever, and his name is Gaius Marius. So if you don't know that name, Marius is at this point probably the greatest and most famous hero in Roman history, or at least among the living population. He had learned his trade as a soldier under the victor of the third and final Punic War against Carthage, Scipio Aemilianus. Then he saves Rome from two more wars, first an invasion by the Danish Cimbri tribe into Italy itself, and then a rebellion against Rome in Numidia, more or less what's now Tunisia and Algeria. In the aftermath, he'll reorganize the Roman military away from its initial republican model, what's called the Marian reforms that will create the kind of more famous iteration of the Roman legion. And then he'll go into politics, and by 100 BCE, he has served as consul, the highest office in the Republic, an unprecedented 6 times in a row. This has never been done before. It used to be kind of the standard, though it wasn't the law, that you would rotate on and off the consulship. He has won 6 times in a row. He's that popular, and also the elections are pretty corrupt, and he probably bribed some people. But he's a pretty famous guy.
You know, I have heard a lot of stories about celebrity divorces, but I have never heard of a divorce case with a celebrity judge.
Yeah, it's pretty wild, honestly, because he's still a private citizen, so he's on the list of, like, potential eudexes, and gets picked and agrees to hear the case. And, like, the only possible analog I can think of this would be, like, if Joe Biden or Kamala Harris decided to just take a break one day and be like, I'm going to step away from the presidency for a day or two and go judge small claims court. Like, it's that level, except, like, all respect to our president and vice president, they're not quite as famous as Gaius Marius would have been. Like, I don't know, think of like a president who's like a famo, like a big deal. I don't know, Abraham Lincoln being like, I'm going to take a break. I got a thing to do. Hold on. I got to go judge this divorce case.
I love that we literally just had a president who was most famous for his television appearances, and your first thought of a celebrity president was Abraham Lincoln.
I don't want to think about that. Also, technically, Ronald Reagan was our first celebrity president, right? I would say so.
I would love to see Ronald Reagan acting opposite a chimp in small claims court. As someone, make that movie happen.
Actually, that'd be pretty good. I mean, I think the Judge Judy crossover there has real potential, actually. Anyway, Marius obviously has some other stuff going on, but being a judge, it's a good position to be in politically. These cases are public. They're heard in the forum. Obviously, because they are cases, there's drama there, and people will go to see them as entertainment because you get to watch people air their dirty laundry in public. Meanwhile, if you're the judge, you get a chance to both kind of be at this kind of center of attention and in your judgment to kind of show off your own intelligence, your own decision making. It's good PR, right? You get to kind of show how wise you are. It bolsters your image. So that's probably why he agreed to hear the case. So by precedent, if Marius had gone off of that, I think this would have been a pretty straightforward case. There's no dispute in any of the sources that Fannia was unfaithful. It seems pretty clear that she fucked around. So by the letter of Roman law, the judgment should go against her. But that is not what happened.
Ooh, all right. So what happens to my girl Fannia, who I am completely rooting for at this point?
All right, so I'm going to read first the Maximus account of this. This is from the D.R. Bailey translation, and then Plutarch from the Bernadette Perrin translation. So first, Maximus. Drawing Titinius aside, Marius warned him to give up his attempt and return the dowry to the woman. After he had done this several times to no effect, and Titinius forced him to pronounce a decision, he ruled that the woman was guilty of unchastity and should pay 1 sesterce, and that Titinius should pay the full amount of the dowry, prefacing that he had followed this mode of judgment because it was clear to him that Titinius had sought the hand of a loose woman with design on Fannia's property. Here's the Plutarch version. When the case was pleaded and it appeared that Fannia had been a dissolute woman and that her husband had known this and yet taken her to wife and lived with her a long time, Marius was disgusted with the both of them and decreed that the husband should pay back his wife's dowry, while at the same time he imposed upon the woman as a mark of infamy a fine of 4 coppers.
So this is a civil case. This is not a criminal case. And yet Fania's guilt in something that is not actually a crime is relevant to the judgment here.
He is allowed to apply a fine in that case, but this is a very low fine. A sesterce is about 2.5 coppers at this time period. They're called asarii. So it's, again, there's a little disagreement, right? Plutarch says 4 coppers. Maximus says 1 sesterce. But it's a very low kind of nominal fine, just to say it's clear that this woman has behaved improperly.
So Fania goes to civil court, gets a criminal fine, but the criminal fine she gets is deliberately set low to send a message that it wasn't that big a deal compared to her husband's behavior.
Pretty much, yes.
That is quite a complex way of making a ruling. Although I gotta say, in this case, good for you, Fania.
Yeah, I mean, it's pretty clear that Marius just wanted to kind of send a message here about, like, you know, I, too, as a politician, approve of traditional Roman values and do not approve of your wife fucking around on you. Vote for me next time you vote for consul. And yet, at the same time, felt compelled not to help out Titinius, who was pretty clearly in this for the money. So he has this kind of symbolic fine and also the judgment against Titinius.
So this is a brilliant judgment that has, in one fell swoop, humiliated everybody except for the judge.
Pretty much. And remember, under the laws of this time period, you can't appeal it. This is final. Nothing can be done about it. It's also worth noting, because I think a lot of people would see this and be like, well, maybe Titinius assumed that she could change. That's not really like the Roman way of thinking about this. In the Roman conception, people have this innate moral character that is either good or bad and does not change.
And the idea of Roman good or bad is not the same thing as 21st century American good or bad.
To be very clear, yes.
A good Roman spends a lot of time massacring people who do not agree that they should also become good Romans.
That's unfair. They also enslave them occasionally. Yeah, Rome, not great. But the important thing here, if a woman is sexually promiscuous, the assumption is that's her character and will never change, and that Titinius would know that, but the fact that he agreed to marry her anyway shows that he's just in it for the money. So in the short term, of course, this case is famous mostly because of Marius, and it turns out Fanny is not quite done yet in Marius's career. So about 10 years after this case, Marius will end up on the wrong side of Rome's first civil war, which is between the aristocratic optimates who want to maintain the power of the Roman aristocracy and the populares who are in favor of kind of the will of the people. Marius ends up on the populare side, ends up fleeing Rome after an initial defeat, and he ends up in Minturno and is there arrested by the city elders who are kind of seeing which way the wind is blowing. They hold him, but because he's famous and a former consul, they put him under house arrest instead of in jail, and they put him in the house of Fania. They assume that because of the judgment that he'd rendered that she was unchaste and sexually promiscuous, she would hold a grudge and kind of keep a close eye on him. Instead, she's like, I love you, Marius. You're the best. Here, let me help you escape. And he's able to get out, flee to Africa, rebuild an army, come back to Rome, and then cap off his career by being elected as consul one more 7th time, prescribing and killing a bunch of his political enemies, and then dying of old age.
Hell yeah, great for you, Fania.
Unfortunately, after this point, we don't know anything that happens to her. We know that her son by Titinius would become a senator, so he apparently does pretty well for himself, and that her other son, the potential bastard, would develop some prestige and go on to become an equite, part of the lower aristocracy. So her family does pretty well, but we don't know what happened to her.
Okay, so even though she has experienced some public shaming in the court of law, it sounds like that didn't rub off too much on her sons at all.
Yeah, and it seems like not to have bothered her that much. And to be fair, I imagine the money helps quite a bit there.
Hell yeah. Okay, I'm going to imagine Fania dying old and rich and
surrounded by hot dudes.
Absolutely.
Possibly also hot ladies. We don't know.
You'll get it, Fania.
So, case number 2. This is a fun one. This one we only have from Valerius Maximus, that guy who's writing kind of examples of weird stories to include in speeches. He doesn't actually even give a date for this one, but based on the dates of the parties involved, it's likely about 35 years after Fannia's case, 65 BCE. So, three characters in this case, really two and a half. First, we have Gaius Vicellius Varro. He is a wealthy equite in his late 30s. He's a pretty successful guy. He's one of those legal advocates who's not technically a lawyer, but gets a lot of gifts and has a lot of friends. And he is the maternal cousin of one of the best lawyers of the time, Cicero. He is married, but he's also having an affair on the side with our second character, Ottacilia, a slightly older married woman. She's about a year or two older than he is. Ottacilia, in turn, is married to another member of the equite class, the lower aristocracy, named Juventius Laterensis. He appears not to have known about their affair.
So right away, I am noticing a real problem here when it comes to the different treatment of male and female affairs, which is that, you know, just numbers game wise, it must be statistically likely at a certain point that the woman you are sleeping around with is somebody else's wife, right?
Absolutely. And I think one of the interesting things about this time period is that on the surface, there's a lot of rhetoric among the aristocracy about, like, defending marriage. We have to have, you know, chastity and loyalty in marriage because those are good Roman traditional values. And yet behind the scenes, everybody's fucking. Everybody's having affairs. Like, seriously, if you are at all interested in the history of the late Roman Republic and you look at anyone, there's like a laundry list of affairs they're having. They're all fucking all of the time, just constantly.
Wasn't there something about a group of influencers who were all extremely on the family values stuff on the outside, and then it turned out they were all swingers?
I mean, if we're talking about Roman history, you're going to have to be more specific, which gets to kind of the issue. And if you're talking about modern history, you're also going to have to be more specific.
I was talking about something that happened like on Instagram or TikTok or something last year.
Wasn't it like a Mormon mom TikTok?
Yeah. Yeah. Maybe that is just kind of a human trait.
Yeah. I mean, I think very much of the Victorians, who, of course, thought of themselves as latter day Romans, who were kind of bringing back the empire and masculine virtues that Rome was founded on, and had all this crap about traditional family values, and who were also all having affairs, right? They just wouldn't acknowledge that publicly.
Maybe that is the real traditional family value.
I strongly suspect it might be. So Ottacilia's relationship with Varro is described as going pretty well. Maximus describes her as an obliging mistress. That's his language. But then, and here I'm going to turn to the Shackleton Bailey translation, quote, Gaius Vicellius Varro, being seized with a grave illness, let Ottacilia, wife of Laterensis, with whom he had had carnal commerce, record a loan to himself of 300,000 sesterces. His plan was that if he died, she would claim that sum from his heirs. He wanted it to be a sort of legacy, coloring a gift derived from lust with the name of debt.
Okay, so this is a bizarre kind of affair money laundering happening here.
Yes, and there is a law in place, the Lex Quincia, I hope I'm saying that right, which bans excessive gifts outside the immediate family circle, basically for this exact reason. So a mistress can't take advantage of an affair and get a shitload of money from the person she's boning to the detriment of that family.
So Roman law does not have any laws against adultery in this period, but it does have laws against sugar babies.
Exactly. Yes, that is illegal during this time period. And it's like the law just says excessive. This could have been litigated around what that means. But that would mean that Varro would have to admit in public that he wanted to give this woman a huge gift, which, of course, the only reason he would be doing that was if he was already giving her his huge gift, if you know what I mean. So it would mean basically admitting to the affair.
And that would cause him problems because she is a married woman.
Yes, it would not cause problems for him, other than probably Laterensis wouldn't like him very much.
Okay, so this is a guy who does at least somewhat care about the woman that he's sleeping with enough to make sure that she is provided for in the event of his death, and also does not want to sully her reputation. But we are still talking about this 2,000 years later, which means that reputation must get pretty sullied at some point.
Absolutely. So the scheme, if you're having all trouble keeping a hold of things here, Roman households maintain pretty detailed account books under which a record like this, which is basically like a promissory note or an IOU, would have been kept. I took this loan from Ottokilia of this amount. Pay it. It will be paid back at some point. But here's how things go next. This is, again, returning to Maximus. Quote, then, contrary to Ottokilia's vows, he, Vero, came out of the crisis. Annoyed that he had not speeded up the hope of her plunder by dying, from an obliging mistress, she suddenly began to play the uncompromising creditor, claiming the money which she had tried to extract by a face of brass, which is a Roman euphemism for like impudence or brazenness, and an empty contract.
Ooh, so she is calling in her debts.
Exactly. And that bit about contrary to vows is interesting. That's usually interpreted to mean vows before the gods. Basically, she went to a temple and said, if you kill him and make sure he dies of this disease, I'll do something for you. Probably donate a chunk of the money. And it's, I have to admit, yeah, maybe you might be thinking that's pretty cold, but this is a lot of money that's at stake here.
So it's implied here that this woman tried to put a supernatural hit out on her illicit lover to get this money.
Yes, to get the IOU that he had written into his account books to pay her a gift to circumvent laws against doing that for your mistress.
Wow. Okay, there is a lot happening spiritually and legally here.
And financially. I want to note here, this is 300,000 sestertii, right, which is the silver coinage of the time period, which is a shitload of money. Right? So first, if you wanted to qualify as a member of the equite class, the lower aristocracy, you need 400,000 sestertii. So you're basically three quarters of the way there just with this. To be a senator, you needed 1 million in land value. So again, a sizable chunk of the change on the way there. If you're trying to convert this into modern currency, it's a little bit hard to do. Detlef Leibs qualifies the like land value for senators as about 750,000 modern U.S. dollars in like current day Rome. Like if you had that value of land, you could become a senator. So this would be like 3/10 of that. I can't do that kind of math in my head, but like that's a nice chunk of property in modern Rome.
Yeah, the senators are kind of the 1%, right? Like they are the absolute upper crust. So that's still a very comfortable. Yeah, that's a very comfortable amount of money, I would say.
Yes. And if you're going by silver value, if you convert it, one sestertius is 0.98 grams of silver. So today, that's a little under $250,000 in terms of value. It's a lot of money, no matter how you slice it, particularly because $250,000 in ancient Rome goes much further than it would today because of purchasing power and other economic stuff that makes my brain hurt that we're not going to talk about. Anyway, it's a shitload of money.
That's studio condo on the edge of Seattle, baby.
Yeah, you're living the good life at that point. So again, this is a civil case. So she decides to take him to court to get her debt back when the gods don't kill him for her. And it's the exact same process. She goes to the urban praetor, makes a complaint, and then summons Varro to the praetor to then have the lawsuit be formalized. The case then goes before a judex, same process for picking one. It's, you know, exact same set of rules.
So she is suing this guy for not dying?
Yes, but officially she's suing him because he owes her an unpaid debt. Right? Because that was their circumvention of the system, was recording this as a debt, which does have legal force.
Okay. All right. I'm beginning to grasp the extent of this Roman money laundering here.
So once again, we know this case because the judex is a famous guy. In this case, he's a bit less well known in like modern conceptions of Rome. But he's a judge named Gaius Aquilius Gallus, who's a very famous jurist. He's in the history of Roman law. He's very important. He's also the reason we can date this case because he was the praetor in 66, but spent most of his time on the island of Kerkenna in what's modern Tunisia. So we know he was in town in 66, and he probably heard this case on the way out the door in 65. Anyway, this is where our source fails us pretty badly, because here's everything else Maximus has to say about this case. Quote, Gaius Aquilius, a highly respected personage eminent in knowledge of civil law, was appointed arbiter. He called in leading members of the community as his assessors, and, guided by his skill and conscience, rebuffed the woman. If it had been possible for Varro to be both condemned and, in respect of his female opponent, acquitted under the same formula, I, Maximus, do not doubt that Aquila would gladly have chastised his shameful and illicit love. As it was, he quashed the chicanery of the private suit, leaving the charge of adultery to be pursued in a public court.
So the judge comes in and he goes, "This is all very stupid."
Yes, pretty much. But there's a shitload of stuff in here that's just wrong. Like, as we've already said, there is no law against adultery during this time period. So there's no way that Varro could be charged in a public court for that. It's not a crime at this point.
Oh, is this one of those issues where the source that we have available is writing from a different time period with a different understanding of the law?
Yes. So he's writing during the reign of Tiberius, the second emperor of Rome, and he might have just assumed those laws had always been in place because he'd grown up with them. He might have also been trying to suck up to Tiberius and be like, "Look at how great this law against adultery is. I love the emperor. Please don't throw me off a cliff in your crazy orgy villa," which is a thing Tiberius did a couple of times.
So this guy is just writing legal fan fiction at this point.
Yeah, or maybe he really hated adultery. Something weird's going on here. So it's also weird because technically Gallus can't just do this, which Maximus seems to assume he can just make whatever decision he wants, but it doesn't actually work this way. IOUs and debts are a classic example in Roman law of what is called stricti iuris judicium, which is basically a type of trial where the iudex has no leeway to consider anything outside of whether the debt is valid.
You're pausing because I was making a face, but I was actually going to make a very bad joke about what stricti iuris judicium sounds like it would be.
I mean, keep it in, double it, maximize it. Yeah, it's... I also, again, I'm not sure I said that right. I hate Latin. Oh my God, romance languages are stupid. We should all learn Chinese.
It just really sounds like something you need a cream for, dude.
I mean, yeah, I think the problem here was that Varro was giving Otacilia the stricti iuris judicium. Anyway, so under this type of judgment, which again, an IOU falls under this, the judge cannot decide anything other than whether the debt is valid. The judge cannot decide whether she's breaking a good faith agreement with Varro not to collect the debt if he doesn't die, whether the debt is equitable or legal. None of that is on the table. Is this a real IOU? Is it not? If it is, the debt is legitimate. He has to pay it. That's it. So under our understanding of how this system should work, it's pretty cut and dry. And yet there's this ruling, there's this ruling by Gallus in favor of Varro and against Otacilia, which Maximus himself does not explain at all.
So, I want to clarify a few things here. Trying to put a supernatural hit out on your illicit lover, not illegal.
Not that I'm aware of. I'm not an expert on Roman law, but to my knowledge, that's not a crime.
All right. Sleeping around with a guy and having an affair with someone who is not your husband or wife, not illegal, or perhaps punishable by a very, very small fine.
Not illegal, punishable by divorce, and also your paterfamilias, if you are a woman, can kill you, which is not great, but the law has nothing to say about it.
But being someone who receives a large sum of money from your lover, that's illegal.
Yes, but large is not really qualified very well in the law.
All right. Okay, this is quite a fascinating conundrum that we have created here with some of the vague and bizarre legal terms.
Don't know what you're talking about. Great system. No notes. Anyway, please don't cancel me. So we have a couple of theories about what may have happened here to allow this judgment to happen. There are some guesses that maybe this was the Lex Calcia being applied, the one against gifts outside of the family. But that's probably not the case. The current kind of theory is that's probably not what happened here, because it would have involved outing everyone in the affair. It would have been a bad look for everyone, a massive scandal. Maximus seems to have suggested that maybe the agreement, the actual IOU, was voided on the grounds of public morality, but that is not possible under the laws of the Roman Republic. It also is not possible during Maximus's own lifetime. It's only during the after the first century or so of the Roman Empire where a law is put on the books that agreements can be voided if they go against public morality. I think Detlef Leibs is a pretty good guess here, though I'm not an expert on Roman law. He notes that a lot of Maximus's language is focused on the idea that Odacilia is doing something fraudulent, that it's an empty contract, she has a face of brass, all that stuff. And Gallus, the judge, is famous primarily because he formulated a bunch of new legal ideas in the Roman system about fraud and how to detect and punish fraud. So Cicero, for example, credits him by pioneering new ideas against fraud, which will be, quote, the broom by which all wickedness will be swept out. And Gallus's legal teacher, Quintus Mucius Scaevola, had pioneered the idea of fraud as a way to throw out a civil case. So it's possible that Gallus may have decided that this was a fraud case and been kind of using an existing precedent around fraud to get around the whole IOU thing.
All right. So even though this is something happening in civil court, once again, it's a case where the judge comes in and says, actually, there's a crime here.
Fraud is also a civil thing under Roman law.
Wait, what? It's not a crime. Fraud is just something you got to hash out in civil court.
There are criminal laws around fraud, to my understanding, but it's also a way, like, there's a precedent on the books that you can throw out a civil case if the circumstances are based on fraud.
Okay.
But that seems to be a reasonably compelling theory that fits the overall judgment that Gallus decided this debt was fraudulent because it was based on these kind of like illicit circumstances of the affair and trying to get around the existing laws around these gifts. And therefore, even though the law normally would oblige him to force the debt to be paid, he's able to void the whole case because it's based on fraudulent grounds. So after this point, we don't know what happened to Odacilia. Probably nothing good because she's been credibly accused of adultery and lost the suit. So it's likely that she is divorced and has no prospects for remarriage and, of course, can't get her dowry back and is forever branded as an adulterer because, again, there's this attitude that like people's moral character does not change. I guess she does get to live forever as a precedent around fraud law, so that's cool, but probably not much comfort to her. We also don't know that much about what happens to Varro after this point. Gallus is, again, the only reason this case is particularly famous. So those are our two cases of women and the courts in the Roman civic law system in the late Republic.
Well, thank you for bringing some absolutely buck wild legal history to me today. And I am going to be rooting for Fania. I mean, go Fania.
Yeah. Hashtag girl boss. Yeah, I mean, I find these cases really interesting because I had to wade through a bunch of like journal articles about women in the law in Rome. And it's really an interesting example of kind of how the even just the way a topic is discussed has changed over the past 100 years. There's occasional references to Fania or to this case, the Odacilia case, in very early studies of Roman law. But they've gotten a lot more currency kind of as the feminist movement has picked up steam within academia, leading to this kind of return to the idea of women's history and trying to understand like the kind of connection between women and the law and how women dealt with the law in these very patriarchal systems like Rome. It's also like it's an interesting challenge, I think, as a historian to have a source like this that is like all of these are men operating in a male dominated system, talking about women in like some pretty shitty ways, kind of labeling them as promiscuous and awful because of that. And how do you kind of recover who these people actually were like through those sources? When those sources are all that you have, how do you kind of try and filter out like, okay, who is this person really? I think it's an interesting challenge as a historian.
Yeah, I've also been there with being on JSTOR and looking for some kind of weird, obscure topic and landing on an article and realizing that it is 100 years old. It is a scan of something from the 1800s. Some of that does show up in articles that you're looking up. But yeah, this is an especially interesting little bit of historiography here because we have the original legal records, which are completely lost, and the lives of the original people, which are just completely lost at this point. We have the record of the original historian who wrote them down, who was himself in a very different time period with a very different understanding of the law. And then we have the progression of hundreds of years of historians who have their own take on things. If I were writing about this case 100 years ago, I probably wouldn't be rooting quite as hard for Fanio, would I?
Or you certainly would be putting it in writing, for sure. And it's worth noting that the historians we have this from are not trying to be accurate about history. Maximus, again, is trying to create good anecdotes you can put in a speech that will amuse people. And Plutarch is trying to like write a moral textbook. He's not really trying to write about history. He's trying to be like, you can learn these good virtues, right? So they're not even trying necessarily to be accurate, which adds an extra layer of challenge.
Hey, philosophy teacher. Would you say that this is an example of moral relativism?
Oh, God. I don't know. I'm not doing this right now. Oh, my God. Dimitri is trying to troll me into going onto a long discourse about how I teach moral realism and relativism, but I'm not going to do it. I'm not going to do it here.
Do it for the podcast, Isaac. Do it. Do it. Do it. Let me lure you into my trap.
Okay. As someone who teaches a little bit of philosophy, and I'm not an expert, I have just read a lot of books. I have found that generally people tend to be like most people. If you just ask them, are you a moral realist? Do you believe there is some way in which moral ideas are objective, or are you a moral relativist? Most people in modern societies will say they are relativists. But when you look at stuff like this, you tend to find that people are at least a little bit moral realist in their viewpoints, because it turns out when you have a society that's like shitty and patriarchal and treats women terribly, most people are not going to be like, well, that's just how it was, so it's fine for them. To at least some extent, they'll be like, that is bad. Even if that's how they did it, it's still bad. Like, that doesn't make it okay, even though there's nothing we can do about that now because it was 2000 years ago. I find people are generally more morally realist than they actually realize. Yeah, that's one example. Slavery is another one. Most people would not be like, well, that's just how it worked back in the olden time, so it's okay. It's still wrong. But, you know, that's me talking through it very quickly, and I'm sure I'll get a bunch of angry emails about, that's not really... It's just an anecdote. Dimitri is trying to get me to do this so that, you know, to like troll me. So it's fine.
Isaac, are you canceling the ancient Romans?
I mean, they weren't great people. Let's be real here. I will say this. Good outfits. They did, like, some real solid looks.
Oh, absolutely killer looks.
Yeah, some quality fits.
Really innovative use of chicken guts to tell the future.
And I really did love like all of the uptight kind of old fogey types being like, oh, yes, the sleek white beauty of the Roman statue and the classic aesthetic values. And then all the X-ray scans of them that prove that they were painted outrageous and outrageous bright colors. I thought that was very funny.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. This happens with Greek stuff, too, that when the Athena statue in Nashville was being gilded, a bunch of people protested. Both because it was no longer looking white and classical, and because there's a group of people who believed it was idolatry because it's Nashville. But that was what the actual Athena statue would have looked like. Very gold, very tacky.
Yeah, I mean, I think when you're looking at stuff like this, it's important to, of course, understand it's a different time. It is different values. That's not like that doesn't require you to then say, well, that's OK for those people to do that. Right. That's like the tricky kind of moral ground that I find you have to thread personally as a philosopher and also as a historian. But it's complicated. I would absolutely admit that. Other thing I want to note here, there is some really cool and interesting work being done right now on the relationship between women and the family and the state in the Republic and in the Roman Empire. But the tensions that stories like these reveal are never going to go away in Roman history. They also won't go away after Rome falls. Right? There's always going to be this push by women to try and seek more autonomy, often through money, because that helps a lot, which you see in both of these cases. And you'll see a lot of Roman emperors like Augustus trying to push back against that and promote this idea of traditional patriarchal values as something that they're like that's what makes them great rulers. So this kind of tension is not going anywhere in Roman history, and there's a lot of great work being done on it. And if you like this time period, check it out because it's really cool.
Isaac, are you suggesting that women throughout history have actually had complex interior lives and didn't just start demanding rights circa 1960?
I mean, no, I'm not suggesting that. I'll just say it. That's all true.
Almost like the tides of history are a little more complicated than some people who would like to present a certain image of what the classical period is like would have you believe.
That's right. And if you want to yell your angry takes about the classical period or tell me why I'm wrong about moral relativism, where can people find us?
They can find us on Tumblr.com. We are facing backward on Tumblr. That's right. I have been posting quite a few interesting things on Tumblr.
You cannot find us on Facebook or Twitter because those places are dumpster fires. But you can find us on our website at facingbackward.com, which is probably the best way to get in touch with either of us with your scorching hot takes or whatever else.
And of course, we are on Patreon, and our generous patrons are the reason that we're able to do this show. I want to give some shout outs to folks who pledged at the shout out tier. They are Jan Leonard, Stephen Elkins, Martin Oliveira, Clark Canning, Ian Kellett, Matt Haynes, Jackie Frostocker, Monkey Sack, Alayla McCulloch, Karen Murphy, Peter Wales, Robert Prine, William Arno, Jonas Brandis, Nicholas Kroll, Jerry Spinrad, Jared Stevens, Jeffrey Dwork, Stefan Hruschka, Joshua Kane, Robbie and Kat, Jacob Key, A House is a Perfectly Cromulent Mascot, and The Fish I Catch Are Rhodes Scholars Compared to Samuel Alito, Schmuck.
Until next time, folks, watch out for any wandering Roman moralists you run into, I guess.
Don't get yourself a sugar baby, though. That is against Roman law.